welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, June 23, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the Supreme Court's decisions this morning in Fisher v. University of Texas and United States v. Texas. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we're pleased to welcome three experts. We have Roger Clegg, who is going to open us up here with a discussion of Fisher v. University of Texas. He is the President and General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. We hope to shortly be joined by Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. And then following that discussion of Fisher from those two experts, we will take your questions and then move into a discussion of US v. Texas. And that'll be led by Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law. We're going to have two opportunities for the audience to ask their questions. We're hoping to get to audience questions on Fisher at about 3:25, and then the end of the call we'll take questions on US v. Texas. So with that, Roger, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much. I'll just give a little bit of background about the case, and also some commentary on, you know, what I think the case means. You know, needless to say, those of us who oppose racial preferences are disappointed, but I'm going to talk a little bit about why there may be some silver linings today. Basically, this is the case's second trip to the Supreme Court. It was up there actually almost exactly three years ago, but at that time the court, in a decision also written by Justice Kennedy, sent the case back down, where it was on remand, was reheard by the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit supposedly, you know, was supposed to apply Justice Kennedy's opinion in Fisher 1, which said that strict scrutiny means strict scrutiny, that too much deference had been given by the Fifth Circuit to the University of Texas evaluating whether there really was a need for it to use racial preferences. The Fifth Circuit, however, again said that no, they think the University of Texas was right, and the case came back to the Supreme Court. It was argued in December, so you know it took the court a while to issue this decision. Interestingly, these higher education decisions that the court has had always come at the end of June. Bakke, Grutter, Gratz, Fisher 1 and Fisher 2 all came, you know, in, were all June 20-something decisions. The vote this time was 4-3. Justice Scalia, of course, in the time between the argument and the decision, died. And Justice Kagan had recused herself from the case. So I think a lot of people were expecting that Justice Kennedy would write a 4-3 decision against the University of Texas, but he surprised a lot of people by writing an opinion that affirmed the University of Texas's use of racial and ethnic preferences in admissions. He was joined by Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor. None of the liberal justices wrote separately. None of them wrote concurrences that you know, swept more broadly or anything like that. There were two dissents. Justice Thomas wrote a very short, less than one page dissent. He also joined Justice Alito. Justice Thomas said in his dissent that, you know, he categorically, you know, would reject the use of racial preferences. Justice Alito's dissent was quite lengthy, and he read it from the bench, which is typically done when the justices really want to make a statement. And one of the news accounts, I wasn't there, but one of the news accounts said that it was an impassioned dissent. It's 51 pages long. The decision, as I say, it affirms the Fifth Circuit's decision. So this is the end of the case. There's no remand. There's nothing more to be said. Abigail Fisher, has lost. However, as I'll discuss, I don't think that this means that universities now have a blank check to use racial preferences. Justice Kennedy stressed in a couple of ways that the University of Texas's program is, quote, sui generis, end quote. He said that the way the case was litigated, quote, may limit its value for prospective guidance, end quote. A big reason for this is the fact that the backdrop of the University of Texas's use of racial preferences was the top 10% plan that it used, and Justice Kennedy stressed that plan was not challenged in this litigation. And in fact, it's rather surprising. I think that Justice Kennedy seems to suggest that maybe it would have been a good idea had the plaintiff challenged the top 10% plan. But it didn't, or she didn't. And so Justice Kennedy goes on to stress that the use of race by the University of Texas was quite limited, according to him, that there's an ongoing duty for schools that use racial preferences to continually reevaluate whether they really have to use race in order to achieve the educational benefits of diversity. Justice Kennedy stressed that, as I said, the use of race by the University of Texas is only a factor of a factor of a factor, that it was always considered contextually, that didn't automatically help anybody because of their being African-American or Latino, and that in theory, the racial considerations could, in a particular instance, might even help a white or an Asian American applicant. Now, my own view is to agree with Justice Alito that's actually not a fair statement of what the University of Texas was doing. But, of course, that's not really what matters so much for future litigants. Other schools are now obliged to jump through the hoops that the court says that the University of Texas jumped through, whether, in fact, they actually did or not. So that means that schools are going to have to limit their use of racial preferences in the same way the University of Texas did. They'll need to do a careful study at the outset to document why using racial preferences is essential. They have to articulate concrete and precise goals, all of these other things that that the school supposedly did and that Justice Kennedy found that they did do. What this means is that it's still quite possible to bring challenges to programs that use racial and ethnic preferences, and I expect that those challenges will continue to be brought. And indeed, there are two cases that are already out there, one against Harvard and one against the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Those lawsuits are similar in their origins to the University of Texas. Both are being litigated by essentially the same lawyers, or some of the same lawyers at least, as the Texas case was brought. Both are cases that were initiated by the Project for Fair Representation, which is Edward Bloom's organization. They're somewhat different in that the focus there is more on discrimination against Asian American applicants, particularly the Harvard case, although, as I recall, that's also true of the Chapel Hill case. Those cases had been brought, were basically put on hold or on semi-hold while the Supreme Court decided the Fisher case, but now that the Fisher case has been decided, I expect those, that litigation to go forward. There have also been administrative complaints filed by some Asian American applicants against some Ivy League schools, Brown and Dartmouth and Yale, I believe. Those administrative complaints will have to go forward as well. So the struggle continues. Certainly the case law is not improved by a really solid decision by the conservatives that that we had hoped for today. But realistically, I think that there would have been the proponents of racial preferences would not have folded their tents no matter what the Supreme Court had said today, and there would have had to have been additional litigation anyway on essentially a school by school basis in many to a great extent, and so that that litigation will continue. So that's my basic pitch on, or basic take on these cases. I know, has Hans joined us yet?
I have joined, Roger.
Very good, Hans. I know you're very busy today, being a person who's expert on everything the Supreme Court does, rather than only a narrow corner of it, the way I am. But I would welcome you to go ahead and give folks your sense of the court's decision in Fisher today.
Well, Roger, you're always you're a bit more of an optimist than I am. I actually have to say that I think Justice Kennedy ought to be embarrassed by this decision. He displayed what I think is unbelievable naivete, particularly, at the end, what you were talking about. At the end of the decision, he says that. This doesn't mean that UT doesn't have an ongoing obligation to engage in constant deliberation and continued reflection regarding its admissions policies. The idea that UT will reconsider this, I think, is extremely naive. They were completely defiant throughout this entire litigation, even to the point of what I consider to be bad faith, which the court just ignored. And the bad faith is the fact that in the midst of the litigation, after it had already been up to the Supreme Court the first time, it was discovered that they had another secret admissions policy that they had never told anyone about and wouldn't admit they had, that provided special consideration for individuals with certain political connections, particularly with state legislators. And that bad faith, I think, should have condemned their case. And, Kennedy's opinion, they use these euphemistic words like race-conscious admissions. Look, what we are talking about here and what the court today has said is fine for colleges and universities to do is to engage in racial discrimination in college admissions. That is what they have said. The idea that universities will slowly stop doing this or that they will reconsider these programs, we know that's not true. All you have to do is look at the many amicus briefs filed in this and other cases by universities all over the country, particularly the Ivy Leagues, and they make it very clear. They see absolutely nothing wrong with discriminating on the basis of race in college admissions. And unfortunately, the court today has basically said that's okay. I would urge people to read Justice Alito's dissent. The majority opinion here is only about 20 pages. Justice Alito's dissent is more than twice as long. And that's because he goes through and talks about how what the court has done is to allow school officials to, as he puts it, justify systematic racial discrimination simply by asserting that such discrimination is necessary to achieve the educational benefits of diversity without explaining, much less proving, why the discrimination is needed or how the discriminatory plan is well crafted to serve its objectives. And, you know, what particularly disturbs me about this whole diversity argument is that it is in itself based on racial stereotyping. You know, it's one thing to say that at a university you want diversity of thought, diversity of opinions, diversity of views. But apparently, according to all of these colleges and their admissions officers, you can be pegged in how it is that you think about issues and what your opinions are based on the color of your skin. That is what they are saying with this diversity argument. And I just find that appalling, and Justice Alito just does a terrific job of explaining why what the court has approved here is based on, here's another quote from him, unsupported and noxious racial assumptions. Justice Thomas also dissented, a very short dissent, but basically saying that the Constitution abhors classifications based on race. And that doesn't change in the face of a faddish theory that racial discrimination will produce some kind of educational benefits. We know, in fact, because there are now studies available, that this kind of discrimination actually hurts the intended beneficiaries. That when students of whatever color or race are admitted to a university or college where their qualifications and credentials are significantly behind or lower than other students, that they have tremendous problems. You know, they have lower grades, they have higher dropout rates, they have much lower graduation rates, and that has nothing to do with race. That's going to happen to any student who enters a class with credentials and qualifications far behind those of others. But the people this is happening to are Hispanic students, African-American students, and they are not benefiting from these programs. In fact, they are being hurt by these programs. And unfortunately, this case really gives a go-ahead to universities across the country to continue to do this. Now, there are other lawsuits, as Roger has said, and I hope those are successful, but this case makes it very tough, I think, for them to be successful in those cases, even though, for example, the Harvard lawsuit, which was brought by Asian American applicants, claims that they were denied admission because the university has put limits on the number of Asian American students it'll admit, similar to the same kind of racist quotas and caps that Ivy League schools put on the number of Jewish students they would admit in the 1920s. And there is no question that is going on, and that right now places like Princeton, Harvard, Yale, other schools have much higher entering requirements for Asian American students. So they are clearly being discriminated against on the basis of their race. But this case is going to make it very difficult for them to win those cases. You know, my colleague at Heritage, Elizabeth Slattery, and I wrote a piece about this today, in which we cited Chief Justice John Roberts, who, of course, joined the dissent here, who really, I think, had the best statement about all this back in a 2007 case where he said, look, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And that's what the court should have said today, but unfortunately did not.
Well, very good. Josh, did you want to chime in on this?
You know, I'll hold my powder for the Texas case. We've got enough to talk about here.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm not going to argue with Hans. I never argue with Hans, and I don't really disagree with what he said. I mean, it is a lamentable decision. I guess the only thing I would stress is that colleges, as I said, are going to have to persuade courts that they have done what the Supreme Court says that the University of Texas did, even if the University of Texas didn't really do it. And I'm optimistic that there is enough ammunition in these, in what Justice Kennedy said today, and also looking at the narrow tailoring requirements that the court has put on schools in earlier cases like Bakke and Gratz and Fisher 1 and even Grutter and Fisher 2, that this litigation can be brought. But there's no doubt about it. I mean, this is not for university presidents who just read the headlines, they're going to pick it up and say, oh, well, I guess we can continue to engage in this racial discrimination. And it's certainly, a lost opportunity to require the kind of soul searching that I think schools ought to be engaging in whenever they engage in something as ugly as racial discrimination. Will, should we throw it open to questions now?
Yes. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. We'll take questions until 3:35, at which point Hans has to jump off the line and we'll move to the Texas case. We have over 200 people on the line right now, so please keep your questions short and make sure that it ends in a question mark. We'll answer these questions in the order they were received.
This is Ward Connerly. I, of course, am disappointed by the decision, but not surprised, frankly. I think that we have lost a larger battle, and that is the diversity versus colorblind argument. And as some of us discussed at the Reagan Library last week, it appears that the diversophiles, as Peter Wood calls them, have just about won the battle, and we need to be re-engaged now to take on that whole question of diversity and why it's antithetical to what we as a people stand for. It's not a question, just a commentary.
Thank you, Ward, and thanks for the great work that you have done over the past decades, in this struggle.
Yeah, and I'd like to say on that also. Look, Ward Connerly has led this great effort to fight this kind of thing at the state level. And what everyone should realize is that the fact that the Supreme Court has ruled this way does not in any way prevent state governments, state legislatures, or the people of states that have the referendum process from passing new legislation in their states that prohibits the colleges and universities there from in any way taking race into account in college admissions. We know that they can do that. We know that it is perfectly legal and constitutional to do that because Michigan did it, and the fight over that, people challenging the right of the state to do that, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that is perfectly fine, and it is constitutional. So this just, I think for the moment, shifts the fight back down to the states.
That's a really good point, Hans. And, of course, you and I did a paper on this for Heritage a couple of years ago that has the language in there that states can use.
We have five more questions on the line about Fisher. We'll try to answer as many of them as we can until 3:35. Please keep your questions brief. We'll go to the next caller now.
Gentlemen, this is George Lanoux. In City of Richmond versus Croson, Justice O'Connor said some really strong criticisms of racial preferences, but then said there might be certain statistical situations in which they might be that there might be an inference that they were necessary to overcome past discrimination. I haven't been able to read the text of the Fisher case yet, but is there enough in Justice Kennedy to imply that universities will have to do what has occurred in contracting, that is, that there are real disparity studies publicly available that are subject to criticism and possible litigation?
Well, that's a really good question, George, and I should thank you also for the good work that you've done in this area over the years, particularly in the contracting area. I don't think that there's anything as specific as a contracting or as a disparity study that's required, but and I'd be interested in your take on what Justice Kennedy says when you do have a chance to read the opinion. But he does emphasize a couple of times the study and the research that the University of Texas did that supposedly showed that, you know, there were these educational benefits and that there was no other way to achieve these educational benefits except through the use of racial preferences. So I think that certainly that's a good analogy, to be used, in future litigation, that people can say that, well, look, you know, this is like contracting cases. The court said that preferences can be used, but it made it clear that there had to be, some groundwork laid before racial discrimination would be allowed. And just as that's the case in the contracting area, that should also be the case in the university admissions area as well.
Thank you.
We still have 5 questions on the line after that question. We'll try to answer as many as we can before we have to move on to US v. Texas at 3:35. Let's go to the next caller.
This is William Perkins. Could you please comment on how this decision might affect private universities? You mentioned that the Ivy League was having these kind of policies. Is there going to be a different analysis that will apply to private universities?
I don't think that the analysis would be any different. The Supreme Court has said that in this area, the Equal Protection Clause and Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act are coextensive. Title VI covers anybody who gets federal funding, and that covers just about every college and university in the United States, except I think for two, Hillsdale and Grove City. And I think that even Hillsdale and Grove City would be covered by 42 USC Section 1981, which covers any school that charges tuition. And which the Supreme Court has said is also coextensive with Title VI and the Equal Protection Clause. So I don't think that the legal analysis would be any different.
Yeah, and we should mention that kind of as evidence of that, in fact, more than 130 Asian American organizations have filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education, whose authority, of course, comes from those statutes, to investigate the admissions policies at Yale, Brown University, and Dartmouth College. Now, I don't think this administration will, of course, do anything about that because they will, I'm sure, be very glad about this decision from the Supreme Court. But the point is, this complaint was filed against some private schools, claiming that they have violated federal civil rights statutes because of their admissions policies.
And, when President Trump appoints Hans to be head of the Office for Civil Rights at the Education Department, the complaint may be handled very differently.
Well, we have 3 questions still on the line. We'll keep moving through them as quickly as we can. Let's go to the next caller.
Yeah, I'd like to ask about states that I think try to justify the affirmative action based on trying to mirror the population in the state. I think my understanding is that courts don't allow that, And so states don't usually consciously say, well, our state population is 20% Hispanic, therefore an optimally diverse college ought to have 20% Hispanic. But it would seem to me that if there are studies out there that try to justify diversity, in a state like Montana, their study might show that, an optimally diverse college would have 2% Hispanics and 2% Blacks and 2% Polish Americans and 5% American Indians. And I'm wondering if there is any basis, perhaps, for using some of these studies from states that have lower minority populations against studies being done by Texas that presumably would say optimally diverse means a large Hispanic population.
Well, that's a good point. That this is one of the problems with the whole diversity approach that Ward Connerly alluded to earlier. If there is such a thing as critical mass. Are we to believe that the critical mass is going to be different in Montana than it is in Texas, than it is in New York? It's true that states are somewhat circumspect in using this kind of an argument, but they're not all that circumspect. Earlier in the Texas litigation, the state did point to the changing demographics in Texas as some kind of justification for ramping up its use of racial preferences. And you hear state officials all the time, not only in the education area, but in the contracting area and in the employment area, saying that, we want a workforce, or we want contractors, or we want a student body that reflects the wonderful diversity in our great state. So I think this is asserted from time to time, but I agree. I think that it's a kind of assertion that can easily backfire.
We should point out, and this was this came out earlier in the Fisher case. Excuse me. That the top 10% plan that Texas put in place, which takes people made the best grades in the top 10% at all the public high schools in the state. That actually did a terrific job of diversifying the classes coming into UT, bringing in lots of minority students. When confronted with that, UT said, that's bringing in too many minority students from majority-minority schools. Apparently, they believe that this didn't provide the right kind of diversity. They brought in the wrong kind of minority students. So even when they had a race-neutral plan that did bring in large numbers of Black and Hispanic students, that was the wrong kind of diversity. Those were the wrong kind of students. And so they used that to justify this additional program.
Well, we have 2 minutes and two questions here. Let's see if we can get to them both.
Hi, Marianne McGrail, an attorney in D.C. Do the panelists view this case as an erosion of the affirmative action doctrine or not?
I think it's a setback for people who are hoping that the court would limit the use of racial preferences, aka affirmative action, in university admissions, at least insofar as it's a missed opportunity, and to the extent that it's upheld the use of racial preferences at the University of Texas. I think that Hans and I may disagree on how great a setback it is, but I think we would both agree that it's, or how much worse it makes the law, but it certainly was a missed opportunity to make the law better.
Yeah, and we should point out we're now past halfway to the 25 years that Justice O'Connor said, well, hopefully this won't stay in place. We won't need this for more than 25 years, when she unfortunately issued the Grutter decision, which said that this kind of racial discrimination was okay.
That was unlucky 13 years ago to the day.
Yeah.
All right, let's take this last question on Fisher here before moving into U.S. v. Texas.
I'm Peter Wood, and my question here has to do with my readiness right now to advise the membership of the National Association of Scholars that any strategy that depends on Supreme Court decisions here is probably destined to long-term failure and a lot of expense, and that we would be best off, as one of the previous speakers said, pursuing a state strategy through referenda and state legislatures, but also a cultural war strategy of trying to get the public on our side, and that basically litigation now simply means fighting against the efforts by groups like By Any Means Necessary to undermine those state initiatives, which, you know, involves a good deal of lawyering, but let's no longer think that these cases, such as the ones involving Asian students, have really any hope with this particular Supreme Court. I'm open to being chastised about that cynical view, but I'd like to hear what the panelists say.
Well, this is Hans von Spakovsky. I unfortunately share that cynical view. I do think the best efforts to fight this now at the state level. But one thing I wanted to correct, and that is, the public is actually on our side on this. All of the polling that I've seen, and the polling that Roger and I looked at when we were writing our papers on this, the polling actually shows that a large majority of the American public, when you ask them whether race should be taken into account in college admissions, says no. They don't like it. And by the way, that majority is people of all races. You know, whether they're white, Hispanic, black, Asian, they all agree that racial discrimination in college admissions, it should not be done. So actually the public is on our side. The key problem with this in the states is many state legislatures, even conservative ones who agree with you, they're afraid of this issue. And they've got to be firmed up in order to get, for example, state legislatures to pass laws that will stop this from happening.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I certainly agree that the public is generally on our side. I agree that looking at the different state initiatives makes a lot of sense, and in many instances is going to be a lot more likely to succeed than federal litigation. You know, with the caveat that Hans added. I guess the only thing I would say is that, you know, a lot hinges on who the Ninth Justice becomes.
Yes.
If we're looking at, it's a very disappointing decision by Justice Kennedy, but, you know, this is the first time that he's voted on the wrong side in an affirmative action case. So I'm not quite ready to write him off as being, you know, as this being hopeless. But if the successor to Justice Scalia is appointed by President Obama or Hillary Clinton, then I think we are in a big hole. And if the federal judiciary, which is getting worse by the minute, continues to get worse by the minute with Obama and Hillary Clinton appointments, that's, you know, makes it less and less likely that you're going to get decent judges in lower court litigation, and I have no idea what kinds of judges Donald Trump would appoint. So, not a happy prospect. I'm trying to sound like Hans now.
Well, thank you, Hans and Roger, for your presentations and for taking so many of our audience questions. We're running a little bit behind schedule, but I'm happy now to turn things over to Professor Josh Blackman, and we can dig into the court's maybe non-decision in United States v. Texas. Professor Blackman?
Thank you. This is going to be really quick. So, 8 justices release a decision with 9 words. The judgment is affirmed by an equally divided court. So, my job is fairly simple. There is no actual opinion to discuss. The important part is what comes next. So by way of review, this case involves the state of Texas's challenge to the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, an executive action that would have shielded from deportation and granted lawful presence to about 5 million aliens. The federal district court in Brownsville issued a nationwide injunction putting this policy on hold. The case was appealed up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Fifth Circuit agreed. Then the case was appealed to the Supreme Court. It was argued. When the case was granted, there were 9 justices. When the case was decided this morning, there were only 8, and they divided 4-4. I think this is very significant because, as they often say, the Chief Justice has a habit of breaking my heart in June, as he's done with Obamacare in the past couple of years. Here, no one is willing to budge. It was a 4-4. Okay, that's the easy part. Now, the hard part is what comes next. I can say with a high degree of certainty that this policy will not go into effect while Barack Obama is still president. I can say with a high degree of certainty. What happens next depends on the outcome of the election, which I don't want to talk about on a federal society call, but I'll say hypothetically, if it goes one way, the next administration will simply not enforce DAPA, and this case disappears. If the election goes the other way, then this policy will continue to be defended. Okay, so let's assume the latter. Let's assume that the next president and his or her attorney general decides to pursue this policy. What happens is this. We go back for a trial. This was only an appeal on a motion for a preliminary injunction. We've never actually had a summary judgment. So at this point, Texas will seek summary judgment in their favor. And Judge Hayden and Brownsville may hold a trial. Maybe he'll resolve on the briefs. Who the heck knows? After it goes through a trial or a summary judgment, whatever, we get a judgment. Goes an appeal back to the Fifth Circuit, perhaps the same panel, perhaps a different panel, I do not know. And then we have to do it all over again before the Fifth Circuit. And only then do we come back up for certiorari for a Supreme Court decision. That could take a lot of time. It could be all the way until next year before we actually get a decision on the merits. Perhaps by that point we'll have 9 justices. Who the heck knows? Now, short of that, a couple other possibilities. The Justice Department can petition for what's called a rehearing at the Supreme Court. Again, I don't see this as particularly likely until there's a 9th justice, because why are the justices going to hear the same case over and over again? They weren't able to reach a compromise. I think a couple cases this year, absent Scalia, they reached compromises, not here. Another possibility, and this one I've seen floating around on Twitter and elsewhere, is that perhaps some of the liberal states that like DAPA, or perhaps some of the various groups that support DAPA, can bring a lawsuit in a different state with perhaps a more favorable circuit court to create a circuit split and then bring this case back up. I still haven't seen a compelling reason why this argument makes any sense. I'm open to be corrected. If they're correct that DAPA is merely discretionary, and I don't think that's how that works, but let's assume that DAPA is purely discretionary. You can't sue the president to give executive action that's discretionary. The entire point is it's discretionary. More so, while Texas has a theory of standing that I think does work, these other groups simply don't. You can't be injured by the lack of a discretionary executive action. The entire point is it's discretionary. The president does not have to give it. So I think in all likelihood, what happens next is that this goes back to the trial court. We get some sort of a final judgment, whether it's summary judgment or a permanent injunction or whatever it happens to be. It goes back up to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit will do its thing. And then it goes back to the Supreme Court. There may or may not be a 9th justice that time, but at that point, assuming there's a 9th justice, that will probably go a long way to deciding what happens next. But I want to pause briefly and mention this case has come a very, very long way. When this was first filed by former Texas Attorney General, now Governor Abbott, back in late 2014, most people ridiculed the suit. They said it was stupid. There are shades of Obamacare here. People saying this suit makes no sense. It got 4 votes. Got 4 votes. I should disclose I filed briefs in this case, so I have a dog in the fight. But I think it's simply remarkable that once again, a legal challenge filed that people said was an absolute joke got 4 votes at the Supreme Court and had a pretty divided argument. And this is with the Chief Justice, who has shown he goes out of his way to defer to acts of Congress and to save things that perhaps should not be saved. We'll write about for years about why this particular action went down the way it did. But this is a testament to people in Texas and the other state attorneys general who were somewhat early goers in bringing this case. I think with that, we have about 15 minutes left, and I would welcome any of your questions. Thank you so much.
Okay, we have actually never closed the floor request mode here, so we're not going to hear a prompt. All you have to do to enter our questioning queue is hit star and then the pound key. We'll take calls in the order they are received. To queue up, please enter star and then pound. We still have over 200 people on the line, and I have not seen anyone ring in with star and the pound key yet. I can't imagine that there are no questions about what happens next with this enormous piece of legislation. So again, please enter star and then pound. While we wait to see who might join the queue, again, by hitting star and pound, I want to make a couple quick programming announcements. We will have another Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. on the Department of Labor's overtime regulations. And then on Monday, we will be back to discussing the Supreme Court. We'll cover the remaining opinions that come out then and some broader themes that have been observed at the court this year. And then on Tuesday, the time for that Monday call is yet to be determined. And then on Tuesday at 4 p.m., we're very pleased to present a special call commemorating the 25th anniversary of Justice Thomas's nomination to the court. We have a number of legal experts, including some former clerks, to talk about his career and his impact on the court's jurisprudence. We do have some questions on the line now. We'll take them in the order they received. If you want to join the queue, again, please hit star and then the pound key. Let's go to our first question.
Hi, my name is Sarah, the citizen. I'm wondering, this is probably going to be a big deal in the presidential campaign. And I just wondered, Hillary came out today and was strongly in favor strongly opposed to what the court did. And, she's not afraid to tell the public that she plans to do this or even more. So I'm wondering how is she so sure that this is going to be a big popular thing in the country that she's so open about what she plans to do? I know this is a political question, but I'm just kind of wondering what Josh thinks about it.
Well, courts stay away from political questions, and I should do the same. But I will I will try to there it is. I'll try to answer your question this way. Secretary Clinton has announced that she would actually go beyond DAPA, that she would grant deferred action not only to the parents of U.S. citizens, but also the parents of the Dreamers. Okay, this is a position that the Obama OLC said was unconstitutional. In the opinion announcing DAPA, they said that you cannot grant deferred action to the parents of Dreamers because it's too far attenuated from an actual U.S. citizen relationship. Secretary Clinton has said she'd go further. So whatever legal constraints imposed by the Obama OLC apparently no longer even matter, as limited as those constraints are. One of Secretary Clinton's, if she's elected, one of her first orders of business is to appoint a justice. This may be the very first presidential election in a long time where the fate of a specific case literally hangs in the balance on who gets appointed. And with the two candidates, I don't need to be a starker contrast on views with respect to the topic of immigration.
We have two more questions on the line now. We'll keep going through in the order in which they were received. If you'd like to join the queue, again, please hit star and then the pound key.
Hi, Josh. This is Jack from Ohio. And the question I had is, what impact do you see the ruling as it is having on the sanction issues that are currently active in Judge Hannon's court? Does this provide greater, leeway for him to pursue that perhaps more vigorously, or how do you see that playing out?
Well, let me remind our listeners what you're discussing about, Jack. So throughout the course of the litigation in Brownsville, the DOJ revealed that they inadvertently granted this deferred action expanded status to a significant number of people in the thousands. I'm drawing a blank on the number, but a lot of people. And Judge Hannon basically ordered discovery. He asked them to produce documents and records about all the various people who received this sort of status. Had this case ended, in other words, had the court upheld DAPA in its entirety, I think Judge Hannon's sanction proceedings would have probably petered out. But now that this is still a live issue, and again, we have a trial now, you only grant summary judgment for the lawyers in the call if there's no dispute of material facts. There are facts in dispute here. And it's very possible we can have a full-blown trial on the issue of what level of discretion was used. We should recall that the preliminary injunction was granted on a record that was, you know, for a PI, it's pretty good, but, you know, for a summary judgment, it's pretty sparse. And I can imagine having experts, testimonies, affidavits. Hell, the Texas AG can depose various members of DHS to discuss how this policy would be implemented. Again, the fact of the matter is we are no longer in a PI, and if there are disputed facts which we reveal through discovery, that proceeds, which is why I think this may actually take a while to make its way back up to the court, and maybe at that point there'll be a ninth justice. Thank you
very
much.
We have three questions remaining on our line and 8 minutes to answer them. I think we can probably do a couple more than that, so please do hit star and then the pound key if you have any questions about this case for Professor Blackman. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Warren Belmar with a question. The president in his speech this morning and the news commentators all talk about prosecutorial discretion and deferred action. Wasn't there some affirmative action taken by the president that wasn't necessarily prosecutorial discretion, but the granting of additional rights rather than foregoing prosecution? And if so, what is the nature of those instances, and will they be pursued as being beyond, as being legislative acts rather than prosecutorial discretion?
Thank you for the question. So I watched the president's remarks this morning. The first thing I'd like to note is no one will be deported as a result of the court's decision today. This has often been a red herring. Absolutely nothing in Texas's challenge in any way affected the ability of the Homeland Security Department to prioritize removals. That was not affected. In fact, this morning, President Obama said, quote, enforcement priorities developed by my administration are not affected by this ruling. So no one's going to be deported as a result of this decision. Okay. Second, what does change is that the president cannot grant what's called lawful presence and work authorization to the 4 to 5 million aliens who would have been eligible for this policy. Okay. That is the biggie, right? It's not that people will be removed. It's that they won't be able to work in a legal marketplace. So that's the key impact of the court's 4-4 decision today. The president can enforce immigration laws exactly like he was doing before, but he will not be able to grant this lawful presence and work authorization. And again, because we have a preliminary injunction in effect, even if this case takes another year and a half to appeal up, they can't enforce it, right? So this is basically on ice until, you know, no pun intended with the immigration agency, but this is on ice until probably 2017, maybe even 2018 at the earliest. So this decision will stick around for a while.
Well, the statutes, I thought, were clear that the legislation does not allow for these affirmative acts. The president granted those statuses by his actions. Is that something that's central to the Fifth Circuit opinion, saying
Absolutely.
That the president exceeded his authority and acted like a legislature in an area where he wasn't delegated authority by the Congress to act in that manner?
Yes. So the Fifth Circuit ruled that the president lacked the statutory authority to act in the manner he did. I don't want to get into the weeds of lawful presence because this will put everyone to sleep. But the short answer is yes. The lower court found he exceeded his bounds of his constitutional authority.
As he did in the recess appointment instance.
Different. One was of constitutional nature. This was of a statutory nature. The Fifth Circuit did not reach the take care clause issue, which I think I discussed in my last teleform a few months ago. Thank you for the question.
We have one more question in our queue now, and definitely time to answer more than just this question. So please enter star and then the pound key if you'd like to ask a question. We'll go to our next caller.
Hi, this is David Trine in Cleveland. I just wanted to follow up a little more on Jack's call and the penultimate caller talking about sanctions. And it was, as I recall, there was some suggestion that the lawyers, the Justice Department lawyers, had actually deceived the court, and there was a possibility that there might be they might be held in contempt of court. I'm not sure if I remember that correctly or not. But is there any indication that the district court might actually pursue those lawyers in that context?
So, again, for those who might have missed the earlier question, Judge Haynen determined that the Justice Department misled the court and acted in bad faith not disclosing them. He said this was not conduct worthy of a department known as the Justice Department. He notably did not name names. He didn't put the names of the attorneys in the order, which I thought was quite critical. But there still may yet be some form of sanctions that are possible. About 2 weeks ago, Judge Haynen put his order on hold, but this issue is still live, and perhaps the parties can work out something. But I think the allegations here will really matter, not for ethics sanctions, but to the extent that Judge Haynen allows discovery, depositions of DHS lawyers, deposition of DOJ lawyers, that sort of thing, especially if it goes to whether the president was faithfully executing the law, I think can actually become evidence that would bolster Texas's case, and I'm sure the AG in Texas will pursue whatever remedies are available.
Thanks.
Well, we did not pick up any additional questions during that answer, so this will be the final call for questions here. Please hit star and then the pound key if you'd like to ask a question. Seeing none, though, Professor, do you want to make any closing remarks before we adjourn?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this term has been a crazy one, and it's taken a lot of different twists and turns after the passing of Justice Scalia. And I think what we've seen this term is how the sort of gridlock we have in our society, where we simply cannot agree on certain issues, whether it's the contraceptive mandate, whether it's immigration, or whether it's affirmative action, crashing into the court. And now that the court itself is evenly divided, they can't agree on these sorts of issues. And this term is really a microcosm of, I think, our much broader societal trends. And I don't know what will happen next. I don't know who or when the next justice will be confirmed, but it will make a significant shift in the way our Constitution is interpreted and our laws will be applied.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all three of our speakers today for making time to speak with us at such short notice. Thank you also to our many audience members who dialed in for all of their excellent questions. We hope to hear from a lot of you tomorrow and on Monday and Tuesday as we get back to discussing the Supreme Court. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.